one of the reasons for approaching it in a sort of an incremental manner with a firm and committed task force in between to ensure that those figures are firm, are hard, you know. I think I've attached the chart to my testimony. These are estimates, of course, by our own mental health division, and I'm sure, again, that they are, you know, estimates to the best of their ability, but again, one of the reasons, and again, remind the legislators, it's not every day we open up the commitment statute, so it indeed has been, you know, a trial and trauma for everyone involved.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Further questions? I have just a couple.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have, if we implement sections 39 and 40 of the Senate bill, additional, a wider criteria and more people involuntarily committed mm-hmm. in the 1989-91
mm-hmm.
biennium. And I know you gave us some ideas that those figures would probably be substantial.
Mm-hmm. They may well be, but as I say, we're not too sure. We won't know until the interim.
Or, well,
mm-hmm. You know, when you broaden it just to the limited extent that we have, providing this bill passes, we'll have to sit and watch and see what effect, how wide that net has become.
I guess I'm looking for a comment on how do you go about, how are you going to go about deciding whether or not we as a state will meet some of the existing needs that are not being met versus opening the involuntary commitment procedure further,
mm-hmm.
or if you want to comment on it.
How will we ensure that existing current needs are met? Well, I'm certainly dedicated to finding additional funding to further meet the current needs that we have, yes. However, I do have a concern that if we look at the overall costs mm-hmm. to the state of not meeting the needs of this particular population, I know we are paying for it probably in a compounded sort of way in other human service dollars.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dix?
Could you expand on that just a little bit?
Well, as I said, if you, for instance, have a family member who has been recognized and is considered potentially dangerously mentally ill, and they do not fit the current criteria for a court commitment procedure, they are ill to the point where they are unable to realize that they need treatment or to seek voluntary treatment, or perhaps there are no funds to pay for the much-needed treatment. That individual must have to act in such an irrational or criminal behavior before the system picks them up to help them. And unfortunately, usually it is our own police protective section that picks them up. And in fact, they do not receive the help they need.
So increases in law enforcement costs and mm-hmm. things like that?
That's my belief. Law enforcement as well as mm-hmm. you know many other numerous.
Further questions, Senator Hamby?
I urge your support, however, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Canis, we'll call Governor Goldschmidt's representative. If you would, identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Janice Yaden.
And I might just, let me interrupt you, Janice. Mm-hmm. We do have a copy of the Multnomah County Task Force for members. If you want me to pass it around, pass me a note while we're at it. Excuse me.
That's fine. I am the Assistant to the Governor on Human Resources. First of all, I want to congratulate the members of the task force in the Mental Health Division for the long hours that I know they put into this report and the amount of time that it took to do it. The Task Force on Civil Commitment of the Mentally Ill Persons has done an excellent job addressing the issues surrounding civil commitment in Oregon. Today, I am here to indicate the Governor's support for making a change in the civil commitment law. The Governor has heard from many distraught families who have had to stand helplessly by while their mentally ill loved ones deteriorated because they refused to go for treatment. The legislation before you, House Bill 2324, would change that. This legislation would make it easier for families to acquire the help their mentally ill members need. In addition, for the first time, it would make it truly possible for the mentally ill to be committed directly to community services rather than to a mental institution because of the establishment of a realistic process. The Governor included $7.1 million in his proposed budget as recommended by the task force to serve the individuals who would be eligible under the expanded civil commitment criteria in this bill. Approximately $622,000 is earmarked to facilitate the commitment process in the community. The rest will go for mental health services. Mr. Chairman, the Governor's office has not had a chance to review the entire bill, so I cannot say he has unequivocal support for all its components. However, if fine-tuning or appropriate adjustments need to be made, depending on the testimony you hear here today, we would be interested in helping facilitate that in any way possible. In summary, the Governor is supportive of changing the civil commitment statute to make it easier for the mentally ill to obtain needed services, and he is supportive of funding the commitment process for the same reason. Thank you for your consideration.
Questions? Representative
Just Jackson. A comment. I guess I would be interested in hearing from the Governor in writing at some point after he has had a chance to review the bill.
Any other questions?
I'm sorry, I was quick in and out. I understand that you testified concerning the expanded criteria in the bill and a commitment to expand on funding for that in the Governor's proposed budget.
We put $7.1 million in that for that purpose.
I've heard an issue raised, and I just want to throw it out. If there are being basically the same thing I touched on with Senator Hamby, but if there are needs at present not being met under the existing law with the existing funding crunch, why would we want to expand a population to get more people in a system when there are already people in the system that are not having their needs met? I throw that out for your comment because it's something that I've heard several times in relationship to expanding the criteria for civil commitment procedures.
Mr. Chairman, the Governor's belief was that the families who have individuals who are not seeking help voluntarily are more vulnerable and have a more fragile existence than those families who have individuals who are seeking help voluntarily, even though they may have the same conditions. One family has no recourse because their family member refuses treatment. Another family may have some recourse, either private funds, negotiations, however individuals get into the mental health service community. That's a valid question. It's probably going to cost $60 million to address those individuals who are chronically mentally ill, who are in the system voluntarily seeking help, and that will continue to be a problem. They are still going to be lined up. This simply gives some recourse for those families who are watching their members, family members, loved ones deteriorate and cannot do anything about it.
Representative Bowman.
I just have a concern that came up from the answer to your question. Let me make my concern known, and then you can respond to the concern either now or maybe it's something that hasn't occurred to you. But what it sounds like is happening if families with individuals who do not seek treatment voluntarily are at a disadvantage now. It sounds as if families who have individuals who seek treatment voluntarily may be placed at a disadvantage.
That would be the effect of this bill.
That would be the impact. So what we're doing is moving the disadvantage.
You have always had a system in place which gives priority over those who are civilly committed to those who are, you must serve those individuals. Is that not correct?
I believe that's correct, but I would defer to counsel. The question is...
You would still have that system in place.
Representative Bowman, if we could at least get the question, maybe we need an answer exactly to that. I believe it's correct, but let me ask the question. Does the system place involuntary commitments on an absolute duty over those that are voluntary commitments to serve the population? I think the answer is affirmative, and we'll have Mr. Murray comment further on.
I'm just making some assumptions because I know that Damish, to my knowledge, is currently not accepting voluntary candidates, but I think involuntary commitments still must be placed somewhere.
I guess my follow-up question is whether the governor's office has done some looking into the budget impact of bringing the current system into a position where we could serve just under the current net, and if you know what those figures would be.
Well,
is there
to serve the chronically mentally ill, is that what you're asking? What it would cost?
The question really is based on the other questions that I've heard on the panel,
mm-hmm.
and that is that we don't have enough resources to treat
voluntary
the people who are voluntarily
right.
I just wondered if there had been an analysis done by the governor's office of what the cost would be to bring the system up under the current criteria.
My understanding is that figure is in the critical mass, but you can ask Mr. Murray when he comes up. But my feeling is that we're talking $55 to $60 million to serve the chronically mentally ill who are in our communities.
Every 2 years. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe either counsel or Janice can help me through some of this language here in the under the definition of mentally ill person. One of the criteria here is that the person is all of the following A, B, and C is the one I'm concerned with.
You're on H5, Representative Miller.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Is in an episode of either mental or physical deterioration or both likely to result in that person becoming a person described under either or both paragraph A or B of this subsection. I compared that with language may or may not have been describing the same thing in the House Bill 2640, the 85 session, talking about the person manifests severe deterioration in routine functioning evidenced by repeated and escalating loss of cognitive or volitional control over personal actions and not receiving care for such. Are those the same, or can you tell me what this episode means?
Representative Miller, I'm not a lawyer, and they sound the same to me, but I would not be able to tell you if they truly are the same, because I quite often read legal language that sounds the same to me, but a lawyer can tell you they're really quite different animals. I think that you would have to get the legal counsel to indicate whether they are the same person we're talking about from that time or not.
Thanks very much.
Representative Dix.
The fact that we cannot handle the voluntary people who step forward now, in the long run, don't we end up paying for those folks because of their deteriorating condition?
Absolutely. We pay for many, many problems in the human resource areas in other areas, whether it's the mentally ill or individuals who have no health insurance or individuals who are on welfare or people who don't have jobs. Absolutely, it pops up somewhere else.
So if we take a step-by-step approach to this, because we supposedly don't have the money now to deal with the entire big picture, we're going to end up paying for it anyway, essentially.
Well, you may not pay the same amount. You may pay out of a different pocket. No one knows exactly what the costs are in another when it pops up somewhere else. And sometimes, how much do you pay? Maybe society is paying in another form. It's really hard to make direct cost-benefit ratios in something like human services, but I would agree that's correct.
But you would think that it certainly isn't less expensive to deal with it that way than if we dealt with it up front here at the legislature in terms of suffering, emotions, and the fiscal question surrounding this issue.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dix, that's a subjective question,
right?
that how much does it actually cost to society when an individual, mentally ill individual, is living on the streets? It depends on what that individual is doing to society and to himself. I don't know exactly what the cost is for any one individual. I'm a human resource advocate, essentially, and I believe that we do end up paying wider costs in crime and in disruption to our economy and not being able to attract businesses and all of these kinds of things if we do not have a decent human resource program in the state. But I don't know precisely what that level is.
What's the governor's position on Senator Hamby's recommendation that we enact the law now to expand further on the Murray Task Force recommendation that will automatically take effect July 1st, 1990, unless repealed, even though we don't know the cost of it?
Mr. Chairperson, I have not spoken directly to him on that specific bill, but I suspect that locking a future legislature and a future budget into something that we do not know the effect of and have not had even a two-year perspective on a somewhat wider criteria for civil commitment is not something the governor would probably embrace.
Would you let us, I don't know how to put this, let us know if that is or is not the case?
I would be glad to let you know for certain.
Thank you very much, Janice.
Thank you.
We have with us, and I just want to mention, not only did the Interim Oversight Committee perform lots of public service in the interim, but also the Multnomah County Task Force and the Task Force on Civil Commitment pointed by Mr. Murray. We are going to have testimony from members of that task force. And Mr. Murray, are you going to come up and introduce the task force?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Joe Murray, Administrator, Mental Health Division. On my left is Dr. Bray, Assistant Administrator, and also Chairman of the Task Force. Mr. Chairman, I'm here today to give my unqualified support for the direction underlying the proposed changes in Oregon's civil commitment statutes contained in House Bill 2324. I believe this bill will be one of the most significant pieces of legislation to be considered by this legislative assembly. While not as historic in its implications as the changes made in the civil commitment statutes in the early 70s, the major provisions of this bill are vital to all the parties involved in the civil commitment of the mentally ill, especially the mentally ill themselves. The legislation passed in the early 70s emphasized the civil rights of the mentally ill. Given the previous 50-plus years of history, that emphasis was justified. Having an additional 15 years of history with the current civil commitment statutes, many people, mental health professionals, families, public officials, and the mentally ill themselves believe that the earlier changes in the civil commitment statutes went too far. This bill adjusts for that overcorrection. The concerns expressed by Oregonians about the current commitment statutes is not a local issue. Similar concerns have been raised about the civil commitment statutes in many states. Some legislative adjustments have already been made, others are under debate. In Oregon, we were gently prodded into action primarily by two bills filed during the last legislative session. With the cooperation and support of Representative Kopetsky, I appointed a 14-member task force chaired by Dr. Bray. Commissioner John Ball represented boards of county commissioners. Kingsley Click represented the state court administrator. Susan Johnson represented the involuntary commitment staffs of the county mental health programs. Myron Katz represented the American Civil Liberties Union. Representative Kopetsky represented the Oregon House of Representatives. Dr. Charles Main represented the county mental health program directors. The Honorable Albin Norblad represented the Circuit Courts of Oregon. Dr. Richard Rawlinson represented the state hospitals. Dr. Stanley Sturgis represented the Oregon Psychiatric Association. Nancy Terry, Alice Williamson, and Gyneth Owen represented the Oregon Alliance of Advocates for the Mentally Ill. Donald Varnes represented the public defenders, and Dr. Darrell Walker represented the providers of services to the mentally ill. This is my first opportunity to applaud publicly the work of the task force. I know you will find in the task force report and in this bill the extraordinary energy, perseverance, dedication, and wisdom of the task force members. The task force met for over a year and took testimony from eight panels representing families and various professionals involved in the commitment process. The task force also received testimony from 35 other persons, conducted surveys of circuit court judges, pre-commitment investigators, and family members, and reviewed the literature on civil commitment. The following major problems were identified by the task force. Mentally ill persons who will not seek assistance voluntarily must become unable to provide for basic personal needs or become dangerous before civil commitment imposes treatment. The resulting disruption in personal life, in family life, and community life due to this delay is always a heavy burden and sometimes devastating for those involved. Second, significant information is often not available to the court at the civil commitment hearings. Under these circumstances, the court cannot consistently act in the best interest of the mentally ill person and society. Third, there are differences in how the civil commitment statutes are applied across the state. Mentally ill persons in need of involuntary treatment may or may not receive it, depending on where they live. And finally, fourth, people who could be managed in less restrictive environments, as close to home as possible, may have to be hospitalized because there are no statutory provisions for revoking a community placement short of another full civil commitment proceeding. Certain Greek cities, we are told, had a policy that anyone proposing new laws had to do so from a platform in the public market with a rope around his neck. If the law was adopted, they removed the rope. If it was rejected, they removed the platform. I urge you to act favorably on this bill and remove the rope from our collective necks. At this point, Mr. Chairman, I'd like, with your permission, to ask Dr. Bray to summarize the provisions of the bill.
I need to hear before I just turn. It's adequate. I'm Don Bray, Assistant Administrator for the MED Program Office. I'm going to hit the major parts of this bill, and if you'd like to follow.
Can you hear in the back row? Good. Okay.
If you'd like to follow section by section, I'll cite the section I'm talking about, and I think we can address some of the questions that have been raised as we go along. The first major thrust of this bill is to extend commitment criteria to allow for early intervention for those chronically mentally ill people who have a history of deterioration to the point of dangerousness or inability to care for themselves. That's found in section 4, page 5, and begins on line 7. A bit of background. The mental health system in the state of Oregon is a very effective one. As you've heard, it doesn't have adequate resources, but it's a system that is a state-county partnership and one that works. A part of what makes it works is that we've defined very carefully what we mean by some of the terms. Chronically mentally ill in these contracts that we have with the counties and the way we relate has a very specific meaning. It's one of our strengths that I think allows us to target on a group of people and make this definition. It seems a little burdensome as I go through it, but I think you'll understand why. The problem, again, that led to this was the testimony given over and over again, both by chronically mentally ill people themselves and by families of chronically mentally ill people, that it was very difficult and at times disastrous to have to deteriorate to the point of dangerousness to themselves or other people or inability to care when an earlier intervention could have solved the problem. We tried to circumscribe this definition so it wouldn't be, in fact, a mindless, or not mindless, but a widening of the net that was out of our control. So the first thing that a person would have to be is chronically mentally ill, as defined in ORS 426-495. If you refer to section 35, page 26, line 30, you'll see what that definition is. It includes those people who have a specific diagnosis of a major mental disorder of the kind of schizophrenia, bipolar illness. So the first criteria is you have to have a major mental disorder. The second criteria is that you need to be disabled in two major areas of your life to the point that you can't function in that way. Now, people who are chronically mentally ill in the state and are in service are on our computers. We know who these people are. The second criteria, first is the chronically mentally ill one. Now, back to page 5. The second criteria is a history of two or more state hospitalizations in the last 3 years. That was selected for the purpose of picking people who have a history of cyclically using our state hospitals and deteriorating. So in answer to Representative Hanlon's question, these are not new people to the system. These are people we have seen and that will probably come back and come into our state hospitals if we don't intervene. So we're not reaching outside of the patients that we're already serving. We're serving patients that are, in fact, cycling through our state hospitals and, in fact, have done so in the last 3 years, two times or more. What that does is allow us to look at people who clearly have demonstrated this kind of pattern and are chronically mentally ill. And the third criteria will be that they are deteriorating. Now, the intent was to pick up on the kinds of cognitive difficulties, the kinds of soft signs of early deterioration that are documented in the literature that cause people to know when an individual is beginning to come back into another episode of psychosis and will deteriorate and would allow for an intervention at that point. It develops that we know who these people are. Not only are they are known to the system. And in trying to do a fiscal impact for this bill, we looked at how many of those people in the previous year who had had a history of the 3 years before that of cycling through the hospital three times, how many of those people actually deteriorated and came into our state hospital? And that number was 400.